The Settlement Enterprise, Delta Galil Industries, FIBI, Matrix IT, Marvin Group, Rami Levy Chain Stores, Hashikma Marketing 2006, Shapir Engineering and Industry, and Chaparral. GPFG still has business dealings with 34 companies linked to the illegal Israeli settlements. These businesses are ACS Group, Atlas, Copco, Bank Hapoalim, and Bank Leumi. These ongoing financial relationships put into question the firm's commitment to human rights. Maha Abdullah, one of the co-drafters of the report and the International Advocacy Officer at Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies, told MinPress News that the DBIO's findings definitely contradict the institution's purported ethical responsibilities. Abdullah said, "These companies and financial institutions claim that they are committed to human rights, but then we see the facts on the ground and the level of their involvement in the settlement. So, clearly, these are all in violation of their responsibilities under international law and towards human rights standards." Al-Haqs Khazir speculated, however, that the slow pullout from the settlement enterprise may stem from fears of political backlash. "We saw how the reaction from the Israeli regime towards Ben & Jerry's decision was," Khazir said, adding, "so some companies would be wary of reputational risk and also see divestment as problematic for their shareholders. It's a process of finding the right balance in terms of their gains and their goals." All 50 companies named in the report participate in at least one of the activities listed by the United Nations as criteria for inclusion in its database of companies operating in the illegal Israeli settlements. Of the 50 companies implicated, 15 are American. These businesses are Airbnb, Booking Holdings, Caterpillar, CETCO Mineral Technology Group, Cisco Systems, CNH Industrial, DXC Technology, Energix, Expedia, etc. More than 600,000 Israelis live in settlements across OPT, and 42% of the West Bank is under settlement control. Area C of the West Bank abounds with natural resources, but 68% of this region is reserved for illegal Israeli settlements, while only 1% is designated for Palestinian use. The continuous settler takeover of Palestinian land has prevented Palestinians from developing and utilizing their resources and therefore significantly depleted their economy. Restricted access to Dead Sea, quarries, and mines has led to an over $1 billion annual loss in revenue for Palestine, according to a 2015 policy brief from Palestinian think tank Al Shabaka. And companies' exploitation of West Bank quarries is estimated at $900 million annually. The DBIO report authors write, "The exploitation of natural resources means that the Palestinian people are denied their right to self-determination and permanent sovereignty over their natural resources by profiting from the depletion of Palestinian finite quarry resources. Individual corporate actors may be held criminally liable for complicity in the crimes of appropriation, environmental destruction, and the pillage of natural resources. The EU provided more than $40 million in humanitarian aid to Palestine in 2021. It also follows international law in declaring the Israeli settlements illegal. Yet the EU is the Zionist regime's largest trade partner, with a total of approximately $36 billion in traded goods last year. Khodair said, explaining that the goals of foreign affairs units often clash with human rights entities in the EU. There are conflicting interests even between different European institutions, each with their own priorities. The EU does not support the UN database on companies complicit in the illegal Israeli settlements and continues to block funding to update the resource over budgetary constraints. Yet again, in contradictory fashion, an EU court also ruled in 2019 that consumers have a right to know if products sold in EU markets were made in illegal Israeli settlements. Abdullah said, on the one hand, the EU has a very consistent approach and position on the illegality of settlements and all the associated violations that come along with it that undermine Palestinian rights. But at the same time, we are seeing that European businesses and financial institutions are still freely and without any consequences are being involved and active with the settlement enterprise. For Abdullah, European business activity in the settlement seems in a stark contrast to the EU's stated allegiances to the Palestinian cause. Abdullah said, we know what that means in reality. It means giving them an economic lifeline, allowing them to sustain themselves and expand and grow with time, because these settlements, at the end of the day, rely on money in order to prosper and sustain and expand.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The International Islamic Unity Conference is held annually in Tehran. The conference brings together Shia and Sunni scholars and intellectuals from around the world. On Sunday, Iran's Islamic Revolution leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed Iranian officials and forum participants at the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized the importance of unity. He stated that the reason for his repeated emphasis on this issue is the large divide that exists across faiths, with enemies attempting to increase it. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. tries to sow discord among Muslims by raising the issue of Sunni and Shia. Both Shia and Sunnis agree on most of the fundamental beliefs and practices of Islam. Their bitter divide goes back some 14 centuries. It began with disagreement about who should succeed the Prophet Muhammad as the leader of Islamic faith, but the two have coexisted despite the differences. Ayatollah Khamenei further said, "Unity among Muslims is a principal command by the Holy Quran and not a tactic dictated by circumstances." He added that a novel Islamic civilization can only be established when Shia and Sunni Muslims converge in a united front. In his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei also said that Palestine serves as the top criteria for unity in the Muslim world. Ayatollah Khamenei criticized certain regional states for normalizing relations with Israel, calling the approach sinful and wrong. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates signed the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords at the White House in 2020 to normalize ties with the occupying Israeli regime. Morocco and Sudan later signed normalization agreements with Israel as well. Daesh has maintained a foothold in eastern and northeastern Afghanistan following the United States' hasty withdrawal from the country, which led to the collapse of the Afghan government and the Taliban takeover in mid-August. Daesh has claimed responsibility for several attacks against the Taliban recently. It has also targeted Shias in Syria and Iraq in the past. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, touched on the U.S. attempt to incite unrest among Islamic countries through its proxies. Ayatollah Khamenei blamed the U.S. for a recent wave of terrorist attacks by Daesh targeting Shia Muslim mosques in Afghanistan that killed scores of people. Ayatollah Khamenei said one method to prevent such incidents is for present Afghan leaders to visit Shia centers and mosques and urge Sunni Muslims to join interreligious congregations.
Yes, I mean, it's very clear that the U.S. has always been backing these mercenary terrorist networks such as the Daesh, and it serves their cause as long as the Muslim Ummah has disunity and there's this sedition and this hatred that is being bred inside the Islamic world, then they can easily control the region, take over the resources, build their bases, and you know, secure their puppets that they have installed in place.
Ayatollah Khamenei urged Islamic countries to set aside their differences and stressed that unity among Muslims will create synergy and strengthen them in interacting with non-Islamic countries.
Israel seized large parts of Syria's Golan Heights during the Six-Day War of 1967. Most of the Syrian inhabitants had to flee the area. Syria tried to retake the occupied territory in 1973 in a surprise operation, but despite inflicting heavy losses on Israeli forces in that conflict, it failed to liberate Golan. The two sides signed an armistice the following year, and ever since, a United Nations observer force has been deployed on the ceasefire line. International law says Israel must withdraw its forces from the occupied Syrian territory and hand it over to Syria. But just like other parts of Israeli-occupied territories, such as the West Bank, Israel has been defying international law and has been building there. The Israeli regime unilaterally annexed Syria's Golan Heights in 1981, but the international community never recognized the move. In 2019, former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a proclamation officially recognizing the annexation, drawing condemnation from Syria and most of the world. Despite continued worldwide support for the liberation of the Heights, Israel seems to be planning to stay and expand its settlements there. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said recently that Israel will keep the territory. He also pledged to double the size of the Israeli settlers on the Golan, which is at around 20,000 in 30 settlements. The regime has now decided to push ahead with a plan to build thousands of new settler units. Since taking office in June, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has sped up expansion of settlements, and the new Golan project seems to be in line with his policy. Syria is infuriated by the regime's intensified violations in the occupied territory. Syria called on the United Nations Security Council this week to assume its responsibility and pile pressure on Israel to halt its illegal practices in the Golan Heights. Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bassam Sabah, said Golan will return to the homeland sooner or later, and all the measures taken by the regime are null and void and have no legal effect. What can Syria and the international community do to push Israel to stop building on lands that international law says must be given back?
The only thing that can be done here is a policy of maximum pressure, either through armed resistance when you are in the region itself, like has been shown by the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, and various other groups surrounding the Zionist entity itself, or if you are a nation that is further away, through continued political pressure, through support to the Palestinian cause, and through economical sanctions.
Israel has been taking advantage of American support and the decision by some Arab states to normalize ties with Tel Aviv to advance its expansionist agenda. So it will not be easy to pile political pressure on Israel at the UN or in other international bodies. But grassroots campaigns like the increasingly popular boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel have managed to hurt Israel and raise awareness about its unending violations. The movement has targeted companies that are involved in Israeli settlement construction on occupied lands. The movement also encourages international boycott of products made or partly produced in Israeli settlements.
Well, I think the boycott, divest, and sanction movement is has shown to be a quite effective and efficient method. Be it, of course, one of limited means in which we specifically only talk about boycotting Israeli products, but this has it has already yielded some fruit. We know this because the Zionist entity has been rapidly trying to ban and illegalize the BDS movement wherever it exists.
Any new settlement in the Golan Heights could be the next target of the BDS movement.
Israel declared it has placed six prominent Palestinian human rights groups on the regime's so-called terrorist list. The targeted groups include key partners of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The six targeted human rights groups are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, Defense for Children Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bisan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. Some of these rights groups have closely cooperated with the International Criminal Court in its probe into Israeli war crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to Palestinian media, the move will pave the way for Israel to effectively outlaw the activities of these civil society groups, raid their offices, seize their assets, arrest and jail their staff members, and even criminalize any public expressions of support for these groups. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has justified the blacklisting by accusing the right groups of having ties with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine resistance movement, alleging they have provided funding for anti-Israeli resistance groups. Israel's move to designate Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations is yet another example of its decades-long crackdown on political activism in the occupied territories. The move has sparked condemnations from inside and outside the occupied territories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh stated that the Palestinian organizations work with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shtayyeh called on world bodies to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. Also, the spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Hazem Qassem said the move disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinian existence. Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq joined the chorus of condemnation as well.
First, this is clearly a political decision and the continuation of an Israeli campaign that has been taking place for more than a decade, targeting Palestinian organizations with the aim of silencing and frightening them, in order to stop them from playing their primary role in defending Palestinians' rights.
Jabarin also urged the countries which support Palestine to adopt a clearer position and take serious and a strong action on the issue. Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's decision as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. In addition, international rights groups condemned the move as an assault on civil society and expressed solidarity with the targeted organizations.
This is a very provocative escalation, but it is, I wouldn't say it's a new war because the war has been ongoing for years now. But it's clearly an attempt to defame, defund, and delegitimize some very, very important human rights organizations that do incredible work in Israel. I happen to have personally worked with all six, which says something, I guess.
Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel, despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any persecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes that has given Israel the audacity to time and again attempt to defame and sabotage the work of Palestinian human rights groups to end its impunity. The regime's latest move to blacklist six Palestinian human rights groups is yet another example of Israel's systematic and relentless campaign against Palestinian civil society organizations and leading human rights defenders. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has described Tel Aviv's declaration as characteristic of totalitarian regimes with the clear purpose of shutting down these organizations. In fact, this move threatens to shut down civil society groups that document human rights violations by Israel. They report human rights abuses against Palestinian children, advocate rights of the thousands of Palestinians held as political prisoners by Israel, and so forth.
Well, I think the Israeli government has long attempted to crush any information about their violations, about, you know, for instance, to the international courts, about all sorts of international law, and that this is a continuation of their policy of suppressing criticism of the occupation and the siege of Gaza.
Human rights defenders are not terrorists and should never be accused like this. Clearly, Israel intends to silence the violations that it is committing in the occupied territories by attacking the civil society organizations. Therefore, if not responded to swiftly and properly, this could give the green light to Tel Aviv that it can shamelessly continue its crimes against Palestinians.
The United States and China have in recent months escalated their war of words. This time, China says its sovereignty is at risk, cautioning the U.S. against sending the wrong signals.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman warned that his country has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including its territorial integrity. Wang also noted that Taipei is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the issue is purely China's internal affair, and that Beijing won't allow any external interference. He was responding to these comments U.S. President Joe Biden made during a CNN town hall Q&A.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment.
What the United States says, if the American president puts in the minds of China, of the Taiwanese independence activists and independence politicians, the idea that Taiwan could, for example, make a declaration of independence, China would act on that. And I don't know what the United States could or on its own, on the terms of its own terms of China policy since the last 50 years, should do or could do to prevent China from acting on that.
The U.S. has recently deployed a fleet of B-1 bombers and 200 airmen to its notorious base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the first such deployment to the island in 15 years. The base at Diego Garcia has a dark history. The U.S. has used the base to launch airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's said to have been used as a black site to interrogate and torture victims of the CIA.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly, I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly, she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. This program, Islamic Laws, we're going to talk about the laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. Let's take a listen to a short biography.
The grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, you know, is it permissible for the person who's like, in fact, having a piece of land as a mosque, and either the sponsor or somebody who has it,
the trustee,
for example,
yeah.
Is it permissible for that person to sell a part of the land which is or has been dedicated to the mosque to the municipality, all right? Given the fact that it is a piece of land endowed for the construction of the mosque?
A good question. Of course, we know that the waqf property is not permissible to sell. It's not allowed under any circumstances, no matter what excuse. To sell waqf property or an endowed property,
mm-hmm.
And it does not make any difference whether the property or the land, piece of land, is endowed for construction of a mosque, or it's dedicated for, let's say, for building an orphanage, or the waqf property can be private or public. It doesn't matter, and it's not permissible under any circumstances to sell a waqf property, a property or a piece of land that has been given as waqf.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, another question would be about the shrines of the imams and saints, all right?
Yeah.
What about these religious centers? Do the purity and impurity rules applying to the mosque also apply to these shrines and religious centers?
Well, based on my understanding of the fatwa of Ayatollah Sistani, he is of the view that it's not permissible to make the shrines of the imams impure. And most of the rules which apply to a mosque or to a masjid apply to the shrines of the imams as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a slight difference. For example, some women might wonder as to whether they are allowed to enter the shrines when they are not allowed to enter a mosque, for example,
yes.
Or stay in a mosque. Of course, Ayatollah Sistani says that it is permissible for menstruating women to enter the shrines of the imams and stay in one of the courtyards and to engage in dua or supplications. But, of course, for example, if you go to the holy city of Mashhad and you visit the shrine of Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam, you see that there are porches, there are courtyards. Of course, menstruating women can enter those courtyards. Of course.
Yes.
But it's not permissible for a menstruating woman to enter the room where the chamber is located. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's located. But elsewhere, except for, because if you go to the shrine also, you will see that there are mosques inside the shrine.
Yes.
Mosques in,
so, and again, in those places, they are not allowed. Anymore.
And again, of course, it's not permissible for a woman who gets her period to enter those places which are dedicated as mosques or which are used as mosques.
Mm-hmm.
And but when it comes to purifying to making these places impure, of course, it's not permissible to make the shrines of the imams impure.
I see. Okay, Sheikh Javid, if you agree, let's take a short break and we'll be back continuing our discussion and rules, religious laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. Stay tuned.
Oh. The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and our guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid, is still in the studio with us talking about the laws about mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to take ritually impure objects with you into a mosque? We know that to make usually the interior part of the mosque impure is haram and unlawful. It's not permissible. But what about entering these objects, like impure objects, into a mosque? Is it permissible to do so?
Let's also differentiate between najis objects and things which are essentially impure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? For example, blood is essentially impure. Feces, urine, wine, these things are essentially impure.
Uh-huh.
But let's say now your cloth is not essentially impure. It is, it has been made impure as a result of coming in contact with something impure. Okay?
Yes.
Now, we have to understand the difference between taking a najis object,
mm-hmm.
things which have been made najis, but they are not essentially najis
impure,
or impure.
Yes.
Like, for example, a piece of garment which has been made impure, it is permissible to take it into a mosque. It's in, or it's also permissible to go into a mosque with a hand stained with blood. Okay, with a part of your body stained with blood, there is no problem, but to take, let's say, a bowl of blood into the mosque, or to take some human excretion
mm-hmm.
into the mosque,
mm-hmm.
or let's say a container of urine into the mosque is absolutely forbidden because they are essentially impure. Or to take a glass of wine into the mosque is essentially, it is haram, and it is not allowed for anyone to take these essentially impure things into the mosque.
But you know, some nurses and doctors, in fact, sometimes use these religious centers, such as the mosque, or including the mosque, as blood transfusion centers, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And you said that blood is essentially impure. And you said that if there is a stain of blood on your, for example, skin, you
it's
can...
It's permissible.
It's permissible. But a bowl of blood, but we are talking about, like, packages of
yes.
blood here, right? Like... blood transfusion taken from one person and transfused into another person, or for the sake of God, for the sake of humanitarian purposes.
Yeah, that's something else. You know, you know, bags containing
plastic bags.
Yeah, plastic bags filled with human blood and used for transfusion.
Yes,
of course. That's a secondary rule. You know, it's a secondary rule.
Uh-huh.
Long time ago. For example, when it was not possible to get the blood transfused, okay,
yes.
into another person's body,
mm-hmm.
It could have been forbidden to carry blood into a mosque. But at this time around, when blood can be sold, in the long time ago, it was not permissible to sell blood because
yes.
haram things are not permissible to sell or to buy,
uh-huh.
like wine. Like human excrement, But blood at this time can be, it's permissible to sell and to buy because it can be transfused and it can be used for rational purposes. And therefore, it is a secondary rule. There's no objection to someone taking blood for transfusion into a mosque, okay, into the mosque campus. Not, of course, you are not going to take it into mihrab or the places where people usually offer prayers. There could be a special place dedicated for this purpose. But even then, the blood is not going to spread. It's good. It is going to be transfused into somebody's veins.
Yes.
And therefore, it does not mean disrespect. It I does see. Not amount to disrespect.
You said it is essentially impermissible to sell an essentially impure thing like blood.
Yeah,
of blood. Course, in the past, but not now. But what about dogs? Because dogs could also be like essentially impure.
Dogs are not allowed to take into a mosque, you know?
No. I'm talking about selling.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Like we have shepherd dogs. We have
course.
Like these kinds of dogs, which are used like for rational purposes,
yeah,
like for
course.
A shepherd to guard the sheep
of
or
course,
the herd of the sheep,
Sistani,
right?
Ayatollah Sistani says that it is permissible to buy or sell a dog for this purpose. A guard
but
dog.
But not a pig.
Not a guard dog.
Yes.
Not a pig,
uh-huh,
of course.
Yeah.
A guard dog is a dog which is supposed to protect a campus or, let's say, a farm or a property.
Yes.
Against thieves, against any threats. And of course, it's permissible to buy such things.
Uh-huh.
And the same is the case with, let's say, marijuana, okay?
Uh-huh.
Marijuana is haram.
Yes.
Know? But if it is useful for a purpose,
for medication, yes.
For medical treatment, it is permissible to buy it,
mm-hmm.
to have a form of marijuana and sell it
mm-hmm.
to people
I see.
Or to doctors, provided that it's prescribed by a doctor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Britain's National Health Service could soon be unable to deliver the care it needs to for women giving birth if the surge in COVID cases continues. The president of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has said. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's health editor, Andrew Gregory. The piece is titled, NHS Maternity Services Near Breaking Point, Warns Top Doctor. National Health Service could soon be unable to deliver the care it needs to for women giving birth if the surge in COVID cases continues. The president of Britain's Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has said. Dr. Edward Morris, Britain's most senior gynecologist, became the latest high-ranking clinician to raise the alarm about the increasing pressure on the National Health Service. As COVID cases rise and it battles a huge backlog of 5.7 million patients caused by the first and the second wave of the virus. He told The Guardian he was increasingly concerned about the immense pressures facing maternity staff. The latest figures suggest a sharp rise in new cases reported in recent weeks is now having an impact on hospital numbers, with average daily COVID hospital admissions in England at their highest level for nearly 8 months. The latest data shows 39,962 people reporting testing positive for COVID on Sunday, with 328,287 testing positive in the last 7 days, and 949 deaths during the same period. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, on Sunday, 24th of October, publicly ruled out immediately moving to the government's coronavirus Plan B, a suite of light-touch measures such as working from home and compulsory face masks in some settings. The Chancellor said the data did not suggest such a move was necessary, despite reports that Britain's Health Security Agency, UKHSA, was canvassing the level of support among local authorities for the immediate rollout of the winter plan, the clearest sign yet that Whitehall is actively considering additional measures. Dr. Edward Morris said the surge in COVID infections also threatened to derail efforts to tackle a huge backlog in cases of women waiting for gynecological treatment. Senior doctors say operations are already being cancelled in some parts of the country. President of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Dr. Edward Morris, raised fears patient safety could be put at risk in maternity wards if the increase in COVID cases and hospitalizations resulted in specialist staff being redeployed to other parts of hospitals, as happened in the first coronavirus wave. The COVID-19 pandemic is far from over, and we're becoming increasingly concerned about the immense pressure facing our maternity staff this winter if the situation continues as it is, he said. We're also aware of the many women and girls who are suffering with gynecological conditions that are currently on extensive waiting lists with no end in sight. With a number of COVID-19 cases rising once more, the National Health Service could soon be in a situation where it is unable to deliver the care it needs to or deal with the huge backlog that has already built up. Dr. Morris added, we know during the first wave of the pandemic, maternity staff were redeployed to different areas of the hospital, and we would urge NHS trusts and boards to avoid this at all costs. Maternity staff could not be replaced by other staff groups due to their specialist skill set, he said. And protecting this workforce was crucial to ensuring that safe maternity care can be sustained. Dr. Edward Morris urged unvaccinated pregnant women to urgently get jabbed. Figures show almost a fifth of the most critically ill coronavirus patients in England in recent months were unvaccinated pregnant women. We're seeing higher numbers of pregnant women in critical care than at any other point during the pandemic, and the vast majority of these women are sadly unvaccinated. Vaccination against COVID-19 and flu is the best way for pregnant women to protect themselves and their baby this winter. Both Labour and the Liberal Democrats have called for some Plan B measures to be introduced, and the National Health Service Confederation on Wednesday became the first major organisation to warn that rising cases risk derailing efforts to tackle the backlog. On Sunday, 24th of October, Rishi Sunak announced funding worth almost £6 billion aimed at tackling waiting lists. In an effort to get a grip on the crisis, the Chancellor unveiled plans for investment in the National Health Service capital funding to help deliver about 30% more elective activity by 2024-2025, compared with pre-pandemic levels. This is equivalent to millions more checks, scans, and procedures for non-emergency patients. Dr. Catherine Henderson, the president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, warned on Sunday, 24th of October, that emergency departments were in a terrible place. She told Sky News' as Trevor Phillips on Sunday, "We're already struggling to cope. This is not something that's coming in the next couple of months. We're already in a terrible place where we have got large queues of ambulances with vulnerable people waiting in those ambulances to be offloaded into departments and other patients at home waiting to be picked up by the ambulance. That's the thing that's really worrying me, that these are patients who have not yet received treatment, that we don't necessarily know what's wrong with them, and we're really struggling to get into our healthcare facilities to then work out what we need to do." Prime Minister Boris Johnson has previously said vaccines will get the country through the winter and out of the pandemic. But on Sunday, Professor Adam Finn, who is a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said the vaccine program would not be enough to bring infection rates under control. Professor Adam Finn said people should be testing themselves, wearing face masks and avoiding crowds in enclosed spaces in order to prevent a real meltdown in what he described as a worsening situation. "While vaccines were very effective at stopping people from getting seriously ill," he said, "they were not so effective at stopping infections altogether or stopping the virus spreading. They do have an effect on that, but they're not by themselves going to be enough at the present time to keep the spread of the coronavirus under control," he told Sky News' Trevor Phillips. "I would like to re-emphasize the fact that the vaccine program by itself in the current situation, even if things go optimally, is not, in my opinion, enough to bring things under control."
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf.
He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, summoned Muslims to think things over. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "Through thinking things over, the fruitful opinion is concluded." This word is among the wonderful maxims. Man can come to a correct, genuine opinion through considering things carefully. He can conclude scientific facts and inventions through contemplating things. It is impossible for him to come to that without contemplation.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has these beautiful conversations with his friends and his relatives, his family and his companions, and the people in general, where he talks about certain Islamic ethics, these Islamic codes of conduct, which are prescribed by Allah, the creator of the universes, in order for humanity to attain ultimate perfection. Now, these conversations that Imam al-Baqir has, if we pay close attention to them and apply them in our lives, we will really find that our individual life, our communal life, our societal life, and our nations and countries and the world in general will be a much, much better place to live in. So when Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is asked about what are the best of deeds, Imam al-Baqir replies in this conversation, in this dialogue, that the best of deeds are three. Now, one of these three deeds, Imam al-Baqir says, is giving the friend money. It's such a simple thing here, but there's a couple of prerequisites that we have. Of course, first of all, you need to have the money. If you don't have money, if you don't have wealth, how are you going to give it to somebody else? So first and foremost, we should have wealth. Now, why do we have wealth? We have wealth, or we acquire wealth, we gain wealth, first and foremost in halal means, that is recommended and permissible means. For what? In order to spend that wealth on the path and in the way of Allah. So we have to have wealth, then we want to give this wealth to a friend. Remember, this has to be a friend, not a foe, not an enemy of Islam, not an enemy of the religion, not an enemy of God. We can't give our wealth to these people or these entities. We cannot give our wealth to the enemies of God and the enemies of religion and the enemies of the Muslims and the enemies of Islam and the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt and the enemies of the Quran. We should give our wealth for the sake of God to our friends, meaning to the Muslims, to the Muslim brothers and sisters, to the weak and oppressed across the world. This is who we should give our money to. And so, as Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says so eloquently, one of the best actions, actions which are loved by Allah, is giving the friend money. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is
parstoday.com.
You can email us